isn't adaptable to the volume of health-related data that we now generate. Even in cases where HIPAA would protect your data, the federal government has granted exceptions for things like web-based scheduling of COVID vaccinations. Now, while there's no evidence that any private companies partnering with local governments have sold health data, it does raise the issue of public trust. If the public does not trust that their information will be kept private, they may not seek treatment. And when Americans who are already hesitant to get a vaccine, this gray area of personal information could serve as a greater obstacle. So local health departments have increasingly relied on the private sector to ease the burden on overextending communities. And if this trend continues, laws that thoroughly protect personal data are essential. Yes, indeed. Democrats in both the House and Senate came out with the Public Health Emergency Privacy Act in late January, and the bill would prevent the use of health data in unrelated government agencies and require that private companies keep data secure. We'll continue to watch this story as we know that our data is important and should not be sold to other entities. Just as a reminder that COVID-19 and the human immunodeficiency virus do share the same risk factors. Doc Griggs?
Thanks for listening to the Noise Filter Daily Podcast. Remember, get checked, get fit, get moving. And remember to get some rest to boost your immune system. And Doc?
Protect yourself and others by staying home, and please wear masks when you go outside. Remember, health is a human right.
This is Norman Sylvester, the Boogie Cat. You're listening to KBOO Portland.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Radio, I am Michael Cathcart.
And I'm Elliot Gilliland.
Thank you so much for joining us. Just quickly before we get into our topic today, we would like to give a special thanks and shout out to the Labor Radio Podcast Network for hosting podcasted versions of our show each month. So be sure to check that out at laborradionetwork.org. You can hear older versions of, or you know, older episodes of this show, as well as many other labor-related podcasts. So it's a great resource if you're looking for labor information. So laborradionetwork.org. So today we're going to start off by talking about the recently passed COVID relief bill, the newest one. The first one of the Joe Biden administration, the first one of 2021. Mm-hmm. It actually has been passed through the House and the Senate, and the Biden administration has signed off on it, which means that stimulus payments could hit people's accounts within a few days. Depending on when you're listening to this, it may have already happened. That's just the stimulus payment. The extended unemployment benefits that have been, pushed through with this bill may take a little bit longer, as well as the enhanced child tax credits and the more generous Affordable Care Act subsidies and, so the healthcare subsidies. All those things may take a little bit longer, and depending on what state you as an unemployed worker are in, there may be a gap in service, of those unemployment benefits between, when the previous ones expired this past weekend versus when the new ones start, taking effect. So some states have actually really worked to try and close that gap, including here in Oregon. The Oregon Employment Department is already interpreting the legislation that the House and Senate have voted on, and they're preparing changes to carry out the new provisions right away. The comms director, the communications director for the Oregon Employment Department, said that their goal is to minimize any delay or disruptions for Oregonians who are relying on these critical benefits. So here in Oregon, we are definitely set up. If you are an unemployed worker receiving those benefits, you shouldn't see really any gap. Other states, unfortunately, they may, those workers may see larger gaps. So hopefully the stimulus check will sort of bridge that gap for you. Just to kind of hit very quickly what is included in this bill and what is not, mm-hmm. Obviously there are the $1,400 stimulus checks. That has been a point of contention on the left, what was promised versus what's coming. But the good news is that those checks, $1,400, are coming out now, and they should be happening. You should be receiving them very soon. And included with that is that dependents are also now going to get checks. So families could get an additional $1,400 per child. which was not included in previous versions of these COVID relief bills.
Yeah. And dependent college students as well as dependent older relatives also may count,
exactly.
which is really nice as well.
Yeah, because, I mean, like, you know, just because you are someone who maybe doesn't, who is over 18 or doesn't necessarily live at home, like, you may still be in a dependent if you are a student or, you know, any other thing that's happening to young adults. And so this does include that, which is very helpful for a lot of families out there. And so, yeah, that means that... So on top of the stimulus checks, there's also the $300 federal unemployment boost that will be in effect through September 6th. So the original COVID relief bill from about a year ago, the CARES Act, had the unemployment insurance boost from the federal government at $600. This is reduced by $300 down to $300. But still, that is, you know, a boost from the federal government on top of what you receive from your state unemployment.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, again, that lasts through September 6th. And on top of that, they have also passed through this legislation an ordinance that says that the first $10,200 of your 2020 unemployment insurance benefits are tax-free, so for houses making under 150K. And so that's a huge thing, because I know that was sort of up in the air for a lot of folks about, you know, a lot of the stimulus money, the relief money, was this going to be something that would be a tax burden to us later on? And so it is now not going to be that. So that's a huge...
Yeah, and I think a lot of people who don't get this kind of benefits don't realize that either, that a lot of times this stuff is taxed as well and it's seen as income, so...
Right, and then that's, you know, if you are using this money as survival money, it, you know, you may not be able to stash away what you need to help, you know, to deal with the tax hit at the end of the year.
Yeah.
And so it's a huge help to make sure that this is untaxed money, so that folks can use it for what it's intended to, which is to, you know, bridge the gap until jobs are available again. So yeah, that's all great stuff. On top of that, there's like $350 billion that are going to states and local governments, territories, as well as native tribes. And then on top of that, it also extends the 15% increase in food stamp benefits through September. That those were set to expire in June, so that is now extended through September. And then there's also, you know, included in that, it allows states to continue the pandemic EBT program through summer, which allows families whose children would have been receiving subsidized or free meals at schools that are shuttered to receive funds to cover the cost for those meals that they would have been receiving. There's, of course, also housing aid to states and local government, or state and local governments. And then FEMA will actually, this is an interesting one, but FEMA will be providing up to $7,000 reimbursements for COVID-related funeral costs, which I don't believe was included in any previous COVID relief bill. So that's, you know, that's a positive step. And then, yeah, the big section here is talking about healthcare costs.
Yeah.
And so,
well, I think it's important to call out, there's $130 billion earmarked for primary and secondary schools.
Yes.
Okay, and so, you know, I think that's really important, because obviously not every school wants to open, right? But the ones that do, some of them can't afford the cost to basically meet the CDC guidelines to do so in a proper manner.
Right.
And so there is $130 billion earmarked for that as well, which I think is important to call out.
Yeah, that's a really big point too, because, I mean, again, you know, something that we've seen throughout the pandemic period is a lot of the costs for dealing with the effects, like the safety and all the other things, the effects of the pandemic, have been shifted onto the individual, whether that's the individual business or organization or the individual person. And so, you know, schools, of course, funding is already scarce for schools anyways. And if they have to put in place all these safety precautions to allow students to come back, that is a huge chunk of their budget that could be going towards educational purposes, that are going towards health and safety issues.
Yep.
So
additional cleaning, exactly. You know, all that stuff, like staff, you know, whatever that leads to.
Yeah, like just more cleaning and all the, you know, PPE that's available and everything like that. And so that is a huge, win for schools, to make sure that they can offset those costs that they are taking on themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's great. And then of course, there are provisions in this bill for reduced healthcare costs. There are increased federal premium subsidies for ACA plans, folks signing up through the Affordable Care Act. It also eliminates premiums for 2 years for low-income workers and those receiving unemployment benefits. And then the big one, which is new here, is fully subsidized COBRA premiums from April through September. So that's for folks who are laid off but want to continue on the healthcare plans that they were receiving through their previous employer. They, you know, usually those COBRA plans are insanely expensive, like way more expensive than what you would pay once when you were employed.
Yeah.
And so those are going to be premium free. You know, the federal government is subsidizing that entirely for, a little bit less than 6 months. You know, that obviously brings some questions about, you know, why is it that we are the government has chosen to subsidize this insanely expensive healthcare plan that was basically just putting money into the pockets of these private companies rather than just expanding something like Medicaid. But that is sort of a larger conversation that, you know, has been, that the federal government doesn't want to deal with and that a lot of people in the political sphere do not want to deal with. And so at least this is something, a stopgap for this moment. Of course, there's a larger fight around healthcare that needs to happen in this country. We'll be getting to that in a little bit.
I was just gonna say, I mean, there's a lot of good stuff in the bill, right? And there's a lot of stuff that, I think a lot of people had fought for. And, because of all the effort that we had in Georgia and the runoff in January, this is now going out. And so, you know, it took 50 days, right, for the Biden administration and for, you know, Congress and the Senate to make this happen. And I think it's really important, but, I think it's also important to call out kind of what's not in there.
Exactly.
So, you know, you touched on it at the top of the show, and, you know, however you kind of want to break the math down, what's not included is the $2,000 checks per person. If you count the $600 stimulus that occurred about 6 months ago, technically you get there. But that's not in there. And then also the other thing that's not in there is the $15 minimum wage,
correct,
which, you know, we touched on in a bunch of episodes of the show, as listeners know.
Yep.
But there is no $15 minimum wage in here. And I think, you know, I don't always like to dive into the politics of these things, more kind of focusing on the labor and things like that. But I think that it's really important to note that all the Republicans who voted no in both the House and the Senate.
Yep.
And it's surprising because the Democrats didn't really force a ton of the really controversial stuff in there, like the $15 minimum wage or the $2,000 checks to the individual.
Yep.
And, you know, all the reporting shows, all the Pew polling data shows that about 75% of the country supports the bill.
Yeah.
And so I think it's really important to think about who exactly the Republicans in the House and the Senate are representing.
Yep.
Because clearly they aren't representing their own constituents.
No.
This is really important money. And again, it's, you know, a lot of this stuff is longer term, like some of the investments into infrastructure and PPE and primary and secondary schools and rent and utility. But, you know, these cash payments for a lot of people that are in trouble, you know, aren't enough. And the $300 extra, isn't really going to help people. So I think it's just really important to try to remember, like, what occurred throughout this process.
Yes.
And even with none of that stuff in there, not a single Republican wanted to pass it. I believe there was one Democrat who voted no. I think a big question to ask ourselves is, will the Republicans pay for this in 2022? And my guess is that they probably won't.
Unfortunately not.
Which is unfortunate.
Yeah.
But, you know, I also did kind of want to, like, take a step back too and just kind of analyze, like, these 50 days and say, you know, okay, so 75% of this country supports the bill. Kind of what's going on there? And so, if you take an aggregate of all of the kind of approval rating polls, Biden's actually sitting at 54% if you round up. And so if you want to compare that to Trump at the same point and Obama at the same point, Trump was at 45 and Obama was actually at 60. And
did Trump ever get to 54% like in his entire...
I'm not sure that he did. I think voters can have a short memory. And so something like this might not get brought up.
Right.
But it is important. And Biden's actually approval rating is slightly down from, you know, kind of the high, you know, right at the beginning of January where he's at 55. But, I think while not everything that everybody wanted was in there, things are happening and Biden's approval rating is pretty strong right now. So it's just an interesting kind of check in on the pulse of what's going on.
Absolutely. And, you know, kind of like you said, that this really should be something that is hung around the neck of Republicans in the next election. You know, there's been a major pivot, you know, over the course of, well, obviously they've always used this rhetoric, but over the course of the Trump era and then really in the last couple of months, the Republicans have really been trying to rebrand themselves as the working class Americans party, as the party of, like, blue collar workers, which of course they have never been. But now it's almost especially egregious that they are trying to claim that when, you know, they've done, literally they will not vote for a $15 minimum wage. They've done things like massive tax cuts for corporations. They are continuing to stand in the way of pro-labor legislation. And we're going to get into a lot of this in a minute, but it's important to counter that rhetoric that comes from the Republicans of like, look, we're the party of working class, blue collar Americans. Counter that with reality checks. And, you know, in terms of, because like you can, there's a lot of rhetoric that can be thrown around.
Yeah.
But actions, especially in the political sense, mean way more.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think, you know, we're not going to be the first ones to call this out here at Labor Radio. Your favorite podcast, like probably your favorite political podcaster's favorite podcast has brought it up already, you know. Yep. But, you know, in the times of Democrat control, I think the Republican Party likes to fall back on the art of fiscal responsibility. And it's a pretty divisive term. I think people bring it up and they think certain things. And, you know, to me, fiscal responsibility means hugely different things, like on a federal versus a state or even a city level, right? Like, I think fiscal responsibility is a much more kind of important thing to run on at a city and a state level, yeah, right? Where those things are legitimate problems, right? Like, we can talk about California for a long time. But, you know, on the federal level where you can do things to help people, and this stuff gets a little bit more... It's a little bit more blurry when you talk about like fiscal responsibility on the federal level. It just doesn't work the same.
And when they run their own currency, it's a little bit different.
Yeah, I think we're going to see, obviously, like I called out and everyone else is calling out, we're going to see a turn in the messaging back to, you know, we can't spend this money, we can't do this stuff, when, you know, really you can kind of just take a look back and Trump could spend with the best of them.
Yeah, I mean, so, like, there has already been a huge call out by a lot of Republicans like Josh Hawley and a lot of them about, you know, harping on needing to reduce the federal deficit.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, obviously that's a nonsense non-starter anyways, because like that's not what the government federal government should be focused on. But also, I mean, where were you the last 4 years when Trump administration ran up the federal deficit and did no one said a word on the
side? Yeah, and we're not going to get into supply side economics or, you know, we're not going to talk about like trickle down or anything like that. But I do think it's important to call out that most economists agree that unemployment money does more for the economy than a lot of this kind of other stuff where, you know, you kind of, you know, dropping taxes on the rich or dropping taxes on corporations to try to trickle it down, you know, supply side, all that kind of stuff. The studies show that unemployment dollars contribute very directly to the economy and very quickly, because usually the person receiving it is going to spend it on things.
Yeah.
Whereas in those other manners, typically it can get saved or put away or used to pay off debt, or, you know, even unemployment dollars usually are better than even like tax returns as well.
Absolutely.
Because a lot of times people buy like, you know, individual larger purchases, or they go and they pay off debt, pay down debt, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I think we're going to see some great stuff from this. And obviously, you know, it wasn't the 2000 that we wanted, but there's still a lot to be happy about.
Absolutely.
For the American Rescue Plan.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, it's a good start for the Biden administration. And there's way more that we'll get into, I think, on a lot of these subjects in the future. Mm-hmm. But just quickly, if you are just tuning in and just joining us here, this is Labor Radio. And we have been discussing the COVID relief bill that was just passed. And we are now going to transition into talking about, you know, what can be done in terms of legislation to help labor moving forward while the Democrats control all three branches of government right now. And so just this past week, the House passed the PRO Act, the Protecting the Right to Organize Act, which is a piece of legislation that we have talked about for many years on this show. It is perhaps the biggest piece of legislation, pro-labor legislation, that is being debated on, you know, on the floors of the House and Senate right now. It is, you know, just to quickly break down what is involved in that. It makes it easier for workers to join unions. It eliminates right to work laws. It imposes new penalties on employers who retaliate against unionization efforts. It cracks down on employee misclassification, which is a big thing now, especially because Prop 22 passed in California, and that is guaranteed to start spreading around the country. And, you know, we're going to see an increased gigification of our economy. Cracking down on employee misclassification and stopping that in its tracks is a huge issue. And then it also establishes new rules so employers cannot delay negotiating collective bargaining agreements or collective bargaining contracts. So it did just pass the Democratic-controlled House, but unfortunately it is basically dead in the water in the Senate. Despite the fact that the Democrats do in fact control the Senate, it, you know, because of the filibuster, because the you know, a single Republican can filibuster and completely block this from passing. It actually requires that there are 60 votes to overcome that filibuster, which of course means that you need 10 Republicans to vote for it, which, as we were just talking about before, we are not going to see any single Republican vote for this. And in fact, it's actually unlikely that even all the Democrats in the Senate will vote for it. And so this has become a major issue, not only, you know, because you know, just because of the fact that, like, nothing gets through the Senate oftentimes, but because, like, this is a massive immediate need for the labor movement to pass the PRO Act. Mm-hmm. I think that we need to start looking at, you know, eliminating the filibuster as a labor issue and as a progressive cause, because, frankly, you know, all these politicians, you know, you can use the right rhetoric, you can say all the things you want, you can say, you know, like Joe Biden saying I'm a union guy, you can have people like Marco Rubio speaking out in favor of the organizing workers in Bessemer, Alabama, but all of it means nothing unless they actually enact legislation to help workers, help working people. And this is the primary this is the top priority for labor in, you know, the legislative priority for labor is passing the PRO Act right now. And that is not going to happen unless the filibuster is eliminated. So the argument that I'm trying to make is that this, the filibuster, and eliminating the filibuster, overcoming that, is as big a priority for the labor movement and for progressive causes as is, you know, the PRO Act or any, you know, the Green New Deal or any other major pieces of legislation, because none of that goes through unless you eliminate the filibuster. And of course, the window of opportunity to pass these, you know, to get to move forward on this progressive agenda, you know, Green New Deal, you know, any type of healthcare reform, and by reform I don't mean, you know, more corporatization. I mean, like,
yeah,
opening it up to more people, and the PRO Act, things like that. We basically have, you know, if history serves us, this year and next year until the midterms to get a lot of this passed, because generally the balance of power swings back towards the party out of power on the midterms. And so the Democrats currently control, you know, by a slim majority, the House and the Senate, as well as the presidency. So this is the chance to push these things through. And so, yeah, it's time now that I think organized labor really starts putting efforts towards, you know, messaging out the need to eliminate the filibuster. Because organized labor did, in fact, go all out to elect Biden, President Biden, and Vice President Kamala Harris, as well as Democratic House and Senate majorities. They, you know, they put a lot of money, a lot of effort, a lot of organizing, a lot of campaign dollars, and, you know, publicity dollars towards getting that slate of Democrats into power. And so, you know, not to be completely transactional about it, but, like, it is time that they get their reward for that. That they see some benefit from that, and again, yeah, all the pro-worker, pro, you know, union rhetoric that's thrown around by you know, Democrats and Republicans alike mean, you know, equal absolutely nothing unless the PRO Act is passed. So, you know, I do think that it's time to start painting folks who say they're pro-labor, but then, you know, do not say anything about the filibuster as being anti-union. And, you know, this is specifically looking, if we're talking about Democrats, people like Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema, both of whom are the most outspoken Democrats in favor of preserving the filibuster, but also both of whom, particularly Joe Manchin being from West Virginia, who claimed to be pro-worker and to support, you know, organized labor. I think that, you know, we really need to start putting our efforts towards messaging correctly that those people cannot be both things. They cannot say that they are pro-labor, but then also be against eliminating the filibuster.
I'm curious what I actually don't I'm not aware of kind of their stances. Mm-hmm. Do you have a kind of a recap of kind of their position against the filibuster?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's been Kristen Sinema obviously has not been in Senate anywhere near as long as Joe Manchin. Mm-hmm. I don't have specific pullouts of, like, their quotes on it, but I do know that time and again this has been since the Obama administration, the first term of the Obama administration, getting rid of the filibuster has been a topic.
Yeah, totally. Democrats.
Because, like, what we see over and over again is that Democrats get power and the Republicans filibuster any type of, like, slate of legislation they want, but the Democrats refuse to eliminate it for fear of, in the future, when they are in
In the minority.
Exactly. But yeah. then they never really use it the same way. And ultimately, because of the way that our politics are shifting towards, you know, Democrats representing a vast majority of the population, but Republicans, because of gerrymandering and other things like that,
yeah.
are able to continue to have basically an equal share of power. The Republicans will continue to use the filibuster more advantageously than the Democrats will. And so I think it's time to blow that up. You know, Manchin and Sinema are not the only Democrats that are against it, but they are definitely the most outspoken, and Manchin himself has been in that position for a long time. But again, yeah, like they are not the only ones. The Democratic yeah. Party as a whole has basically refused to take this on for fear of it being, you know, sacrosanct. But this is just, I think that we are at a point now where Democrats do not use it the same way as Republicans, and ultimately it ends up hurting Democrats more than Republicans. And Republicans, as we see, when they take power, they push through a massive slate. Like their entire agenda, they push that through when they have power. And Democrats do not tend to be able to enact as much in their window of opportunity as
Republicans. Yeah, I mean, I might argue they yeah. push through things that don't really require policy. Because
Republicans or Democrats?
The Republicans, okay. I would say. Like, because, you know, you think back to, like, Trump's first time. Like, they couldn't even replace the ACA.
True.
Because they really didn't even agree on what they would do to replace it. Mm-hmm. And so they just kind of sat around and didn't do anything. So, yeah. I mean, I think when it comes to actually, like, actual policy development, they can get stuck sometimes. You know, and again, we don't like to go too far on the politics thing, but... You know, it seems to me like the Democrats, there's a general more consensus out amongst the party of like, here are the actions we would take.
Right.
Whereas the Republican stance is usually no. And then if they have the chance to kind of do something, then they kind of figure it out from there.
Yeah.
Mostly their stance is just no.
Right.
Except
when we're talking about tax cuts.
Yeah. Or yeah. We're talking about
elimination of like, you know, worker protection,
sure.
environmental protections, things like that.
Yeah. Sure, sure. Yeah. But they tend to be the party of no. And then if they're actually trying to implement, you know, actual policy, there's less consensus amongst right. them. And there can be division and things yeah. like that. Yeah.
And they tend to represent a sort of more narrow viewpoint than the Democrats have a larger coalition. I mean, as we mentioned, like they represent numerically more people, a more diverse set of this country than the Republicans do. And therefore, they do have to pander to a lot of different issues, whereas the Republicans basically run on three things, and they yeah. you know, continue, like, wherever they are in the country, they can push those, you know, those few topics. But it is historically true that the Democrats tend to try and get more bipartisanship when they are in power, or try mm-hmm. to, you know, make sure that things aren't... They don't try to use power, wield power the same way the Republicans do. And unfortunately, that has gotten us to a point where we continue to see... Democrats not being able to push through the massive slate, the full agenda that they want, when Republicans yeah. tend to be able to push through a lot of the things they do want. Unfortunately, we're running out of time, so like we could probably get in the weeds a little bit more on this, but needless to say that, you know, obviously there's a lot more involved in what needs to happen in the Senate and being able, Democrats being able to wield power to help their base, but I think that it's time we start looking at what the filibuster has been preventing and what it is that could be done to at least pressure Democrats to have a conversation about it and to maybe open that up to, you know, or open their party up to potentially eliminating it so that they could push through things like the PRO Act as well as, you know, any type of like green infrastructure deals or any type of healthcare reforms. And so, you know, again, it's just probably time to start painting folks who do not support filibuster but use pro-labor or pro-progressive rhetoric as folks who need to be discussed and who need to be addressed on that issue. Just quickly, you know, obviously we touched on it a little bit before, but there is a massive historic unionization effort happening right now with Amazon workers in Bessemer, Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
They, you know, the workers there, the 5,800 workers at the warehouse facility in Bessemer have the chance. They are currently voting on becoming the first unionized Amazon facility in the U.S., which would be a huge win yeah. for labor. And we talked about this a little bit last month, but Amazon, of course, you know, as is their wont, they immediately responded by hiring or retaining the services of a Koch brother-backed union busting specialist, a law firm, in Russell Brown and RWP Labor. We've seen a lot of things that the firm has already rolled out, including things like, you know, filing a petition to delay the vote by making the union drive include more workers, sending out mass texts warning folks to vote no, or sorry, warning them not to vote yes. Workers are receiving 5 texts a day. Setting up anti-union websites, having sponsored ads on Facebook, putting up vote no signs in bathroom stalls, and potentially, you know, even most egregiously, changing the traffic patterns outside of the facility so that organizers, you know, extending green, maximum green times for the lights so that organizers aren't able to catch and talk to incoming and outgoing workers outside the facility off their property. So those things are noted and have been in place for a while. A new thing that has come up recently, which is, you know, a big question mark, is that there was a massive call for a Amazon boycott from March 7th through 13th, I believe. And this was, you know, this has spread pretty widely, and a lot of people, you know, maybe may have followed through on it, or at least like promoted it. But more recently, it has become clear that actually the organization, the labor organization, or the union, had nothing to do with this boycott, and in fact were against it. And it has, as people have dug down, they've discovered that the group that put out the call is kind of a small, unknown, you know, generic leftist unification party. So, you know, there's a lot more we can get into this, but ultimately, I think what this points to is potentially, you know, we don't know yet, but potentially this could be another tactic being brought about by the anti-union firm that Amazon has hired to basically offset
the regardless union. of what we know or don't know, it's definitely going to be a fight, and I think it's an important fight to keep an eye on and make sure it gets visibility, you know, throughout the country, not just in Alabama, so other, you know, warehouses or other groups of, you know, workers can get inspired. So
yeah, because that could happen in any other unionization drive anywhere, so be aware of that. We unfortunately are out of time. We will pick up a lot of these subjects again when we're back on next month. Thank you so much for listening. If you are